from the VOA News Center in Washington, this is Talk to America.
Hello and welcome to Talk to America for Thursday, October 12, 2006. I'm Rick Pantaleo. The human brain has long fascinated and mystified mankind. It's Mother Nature's ultimate computer. Today we'll take a journey through the brain, what it does, how it does what it does, and what fascinating new discoveries are being made about it. We want to know what you think. If you have questions to ask, comments to make, or an opinion to express, please call us and take part in today's program. For further details on how you can participate, here's Patrice Michael with more.
To participate in today's show, call us collect at +1-202-619-3111. You can also share your thoughts by email, and we now take your questions by SMS text messaging. For complete details and information on how to participate, visit our website at voanews.com/talk. So get in touch and join us now on Talk to America.
The human brain controls lower or involuntary activities such as heartbeat, respiration, and digestion, as well as sensation, movement, and a variety of special senses. Our brain also controls higher-order conscious activities such as thought, reasoning, and abstraction. The human brain is generally regarded as more capable of these higher-order activities than that of any other known species. And even though science continues to give us even ever-increasing insights into how the brain works, much of it is still pretty much a mystery. And today we'll explore this fascinating unknown territory and take a journey into the human's brain. Joining me by telephone, my guests today are Dr. Daniel H. Lewenstein, MD, who is vice chairman of the Department of Neurology, University of California at San Francisco, and Monica Hurdle, who is assistant professor of the Department of Mathematics at the Florida State University. Welcome both to Talk to America.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Dr. Lowenstein, what fascinates you most about the human brain?
Well, I think as a starting point, the fascination comes from what I think is an inarguable fact, and that is that the human brain is the most complex entity in our known universe.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a huge number of functions that the brain is capable of, and at this point in our time, we are really unclear as to how most of these functions truly work.
And Ms. Hurdle, how about you? You're taking your study, your research of the brain, your expertise is from a unique perspective, and that's from a mathematical standpoint.
Yes. I'm trying to use mathematics and computing to help neuroscientists and radiologists and researchers gain new insights into data from the brain. In particular, I work with magnetic resonance imaging, and I'm trying to help gain new ways of looking at the data, visualizing the data, so we can better understand how function works of the brain and anatomy, and hopefully eventually extending that to diseases and understanding where diseases affect the brain and how the brain changes as we age.
So in other words, the work that you're primarily involved in deals with the scientific, more almost the computer aspect of diagnosis and just research into the brain itself, using the equipment for diagnosis and developing a better way of looking at the brain.
Right.
Okay. I was just trying to understand exactly, because when you think of mathematics, of course, you think of the brain, because you normally if you are working with mathematics, you have to be pretty smart. You need to use your brain. But how it applies to study of the brain, I thought was quite fascinating.
Yeah. I'm using a lot of new tools, and mathematics is really a relatively new discipline coming into the neuroscience field. Traditionally, it's, you know, medical doctors, psychiatrists, biomedical engineering has looked into research in the brain, either through like imaging, developing new imaging techniques to look at the way the brain functions or the anatomy of the brain. But it's been relatively recent that mathematicians have begun to delve into trying to help researchers in this area and gain new insights. And mathematics has a lot to offer, different sorts of techniques, analysis techniques, ways of comparing different brains from MRI data, because everybody's brain is slightly different in terms of the folding patterns. I'm sure most people have seen pictures of the brain and see how highly folded it is. And these folds vary quite a lot in terms of their size and shape across individuals. So it makes it very difficult to understand the brain in terms of what constitutes normal function, because just like with anything, there's a huge variability in terms of what people can do.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to quantify these features of the brain is very difficult, and that's where mathematics can play a role.
And Dr. Lowenstein, this is quite fascinating. I mean, to have such a cross-breeding of different disciplines in science to sort of get together to work toward researching the brain, what kind of diagnostic or research tools do you have available to you now?
Well, it is true that the study of the brain has brought together an amazing tapestry of individuals from so many different fields, just as we've just learned, mathematics combined with engineering, combined with physicists, along with biologists, has given us a tremendous array of techniques. So, as all of the listeners are aware, we begin with using a time-honored approach to understanding how the brain works, and that is by listening to the patient and seeing whether they're capable of making their own observations on how their brain is working, which is kind of an interesting thought, right?
Right.
And then we use a neurologic exam, which allows us to test such things as the basic senses, vision and sensation and so forth, and motor function. But then we've now been able to, for now many decades, augment the basic exam by a variety of tests, ranging from electrical studies of the nerves and the muscles to the kind of sophisticated imaging that we were just talking about,
mm-hmm.
Both the basic MRI scanning and now functional MRI scan, which allows us to see how the brain is working in addition to its structure.
Dr. Lowenstein, when you're looking at the brain, I can understand why it's been a source of fascination and mystery for so many years, because when you think about it, the human body is a fantastic machine to begin with. But when you're talking about other organs such as the heart, the lungs, the liver, and so forth, you're dealing with basic functions, such as the heart is responsible for circulating blood, the lungs, of course, for processing oxygen, the liver, et cetera. But with the brain, you're dealing with a multitasking, multifunctional organ.
Right. Well, you know, it wasn't always appreciated thus, right?
Right.
About 2,000 years ago, people thought that the most high-order functions of an individual resided in the heart and the liver.
Right.
And before then, of course, the Egyptians used to actually toss out the brain during the embalming because it was thought least important.
Mm-hmm.
And remarkably, even 1,000 years ago, although people did feel as though basic functions like emotions and memory and so forth did exist somewhere up in the head, they actually placed it in the what we call the cerebral spinal fluid, the clear water-like fluid that bathes and encases the brain and we now know is meant to just protect it from injury.
Mm-hmm.
No one ever thought that these most remarkable functions of a human being resided in that gray white matter of the substance of the brain itself.
I understand that's one of the myths about the brain. People call it gray matter, and that it doesn't really turn gray until it's actually preserved, that normally it's pink.
That's exactly
okay.
Right.
There's so many myths around the brain that it's fascinating to see them being debunked, such as I know for years people have been saying we only use like 10% of our brain power, where that's also a misnomer.
Right. One way to think about our ability to appreciate what the brain is doing is to recognize that in consciousness, it's quite clear that that's only a small fraction of what the brain is capable of doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for listeners, a elegant example of that is something that we call blind sight.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone knows that we are able to take in information from the outside world, and we see a representation of the world that's built up based on our brain, and we're conscious of that. When we see something move, we pay attention to it. But what is remarkable is that there have been some amazing studies of people who have lost their sight. They are blind. They don't see anything.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you give them the following test, you stand in front of them, you hold up your hands, one hand on the right, one on the left, and you tell the person, I'm going to wiggle a finger in one hand or the other. It's going to be on your right or your left.
Mm-hmm.
And I want you to tell me which hand is moving. And the person will say, well, this is kind of a waste of time because
right.
I don't see anything. Mm-hmm. And you say, that's okay, I understand that, but I just want you to make a guess. You have to make a guess, right or left.
Mm-hmm.
And you do this study and you find out that these people will be right more than 90% of the time.
So there is that, in other words, the extra sense that we have talked about in the past, but rarely has it been given the kind of scientific attention it needs. In other words, when someone is missing a particular sense, be it sight or be it through hearing, that they develop other senses.
Well, no, in this particular case, it means that although they are not conscious of their vision,
mm-hmm.
they still are capable of seeing.
Okay. You mean actually physically seeing, or is it through a sensing technique?
No, they are seeing, but it represents the fact that all of us have an unconscious function of the brain
mm-hmm.
that by definition you can't be in touch with your internal thoughts, but it's still working.
Okay, in other words, it's a definition of how we see.
That's exactly right.
Okay, now I understand. Looking at this from a mathematical, from a scientific perspective, Ms. Herdahl, are you able to differentiate different situations regarding one brain from another? For example, if a person is blind, it displays this kind of data versus if a person has all the senses?
Well, most certainly. That comes through some of the functional type of data that can be collected that Dr. Lewistein was talking about. There are many different ways of measuring the anatomy of the brain as well as the function of the brain. So certainly when there are, you know, there's damage to the brain, perhaps one of the senses is missing, like with blindness or say through stroke where there might be some motor
mm-hmm.
Problems, most definitely through the functional activity of the brain, through that work like electrical activity of the brain, the brain waves, or functional MRI, which measures the metabolic activity of the brain, you can definitely see regions of the brain that are affected through through certain diseases or deficiencies or problems. The real difficulty, from my point of view, becomes when you're looking at diseases that maybe aren't quite such a physical base, whether it's perhaps bipolar disorder,
mm-hmm.
Depression, schizophrenia, other sorts of syndromes or cognitive problems such as Alzheimer's, trying to detect these types of diseases that maybe more manifest themselves as cognitive problems or difficulties rather than physical
mm-hmm.
difficulties is really what becomes difficult. We don't have yet the functional techniques that can measure perhaps at a resolution quite good enough to detect these types of diseases in the brain. In some cases they can, but this is of course why these diseases are difficult to diagnose as well, is because there's no clear-cut way of measuring the symptoms.
Mm-hmm. Along with the physical construction of the brain, Dr. Lowenstein, we've often heard about the use of chemistry and the balance of chemicals in a human's brain regarding certain mental illnesses and perhaps physical illnesses relating to the brain as well.
No question about that. And one a powerful example of the importance of basic molecules in the function of the brain is the spectrum of diseases known as epilepsy.
Mm-hmm.
Epilepsy can be caused by a variety of of things, including, for example, head trauma or infection to the brain. In that case, we think that it's a manifestation of actual damage to the structure of the brain itself.
Mm-hmm. And you're director of the UCSF Epilepsy Center.
I am.
And since we can talk a little bit about that specifically, what have we learned in recent years about epilepsy that perhaps dispels some previously held myths about the disease?
Well, probably the biggest breakthrough in the last decade has been our understanding of the genetic basis of many forms of epilepsy. And this then would be a case where the brain of a person with seizures looks completely normal, but in fact their seizures are coming from a chemical disturbance. And in fact, the specific gene mutations that have been identified over the last 10 years are, for the most part, in pure forms of epilepsy, due to abnormalities in what we call ion channels.
Mm-hmm.
An ion channel is a molecule that has a hole in the center of it, and it controls the passage of charged ions, things like sodium and potassium and chloride, in and out of the cell. And it's the movement of those charged ions that determine the excitability of neurons.
Mm-hmm.
And epilepsy is a disorder of the excitability of the brain.
Ms. Herdahl, you keep talking about the use of MRIs, magnetic resonance imaging. Do you see any other kind of tools on the horizon that shows promise?
Well, there are a lot of up-and-coming tools. The main thing is trying to get better resolution in the scans. So one new type of scan, or relatively new, is functional MRI, which we've mentioned previously. This is a way of measuring the metabolic activity of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
There's other new types of recordings and measurement devices becoming available. Optical imaging is another type of imaging.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of work, too, is focusing on trying to improve the resolution. So that means trying to get better pictures or better images of the brain, whether it be the anatomy of the brain or better time resolution, so being able to take better or faster measurements of how the brain activity is actually functioning. Because depending upon the technique you're using, sometimes you can only take measurements of the brain, say, every few seconds or even every minute. And, of course, a lot of brain function goes on in that time period,
mm-hmm.
where there are other techniques that can perhaps take measurements every millisecond, every 1,000th of a second. So you can get a lot of information in those types of scans. So one of the big areas of research is trying to improve the resolution and trying to combine these techniques, because all of these different techniques measure something slightly differently.
Mm-hmm.
And they all help shed a bit of a picture of what's going on. And of course, we want to get the best picture possible.
Well, it sounds fantastic to have a very distinct visual picture of the brain. Are there any diagnostic or research tools available or being developed that, in other words, zero in specifically on data regarding how the brain functions?
Yes, there's a lot of different techniques that do that. One of the focuses of my research is trying to look at specific regions of the brain. And as I mentioned earlier, everybody's brain is slightly different in terms of their folding patterns. So what we want to do is try to compare different regions of the brain across different subjects, either in normal populations or populations with different ages or populations that have different diseases, and try to quantify what's different about these regions of the brain. And that's where some of the mathematic tools that I'm developing are coming into play. We're looking at things such as how folded the brain is, so how curvy it is, things like the area of the brain, the thickness of the brain. There have been a number of studies showing that in different diseases, there's a thin layer of the brain, what you referred to before as the gray matter,
mm-hmm.
which actually appears different. It does appear gray on MRI scans as opposed to the brain tissue underneath, which is called the white matter.
Mm-hmm.
And this gray matter is on average 3 to 5 millimeters thick. And in different diseases such as Alzheimer's, it's been shown that the gray matter thins or changes thickness in different regions of the brain as compared to the normal aging process. So this is where mathematics is coming in, trying to quantify some of these different anatomical or morphological changes that occur in the brain.
Dr. Lowenstein, when you're talking about the development of the brain, of course, you're mostly thinking about in utero as a child is developing in its mother's womb. Does the brain continue to grow, I guess, or continue to better itself, to develop once a person is born?
Oh, yes. And, of course, anyone who has raised teenagers knows knows and hopes for that, right?
Enough said.
but we're quite sure now that the development of the brain continues well into the early 20s. And the white matter, for example, is not fully and completely mature until roughly age 24 and 25. And then, of course, there's also been the recent discovery that new neurons are being produced by the human brain for many decades.
Now, and that's strictly from a physiological perspective. And I guess what I was getting confused with a little bit was the mental capacity and the ability to utilize the brain. But I guess looking at it from a physical standpoint, it's almost like a fruit that's ripening.
That's a good analogy.
Wonderful. And you say this continues through the 20s, through a person's 20s?
Yes.
And what happens after that?
Well, the brain certainly appears to have the capacity for taking in huge amounts of new knowledge and the development of what I suppose we could say is wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
However, a certain function, such as memory, do show a decline once we get into our 40s and 50s for most people.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, that seems to be a fact of life that we all have to contend with.
Is there anything a person can do to keep their brains healthy, to keep it developing past its expected growth rate?
Well, all the studies that have been done on this very important topic point to the idea that it's extremely important and vital to use our brain as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
There have been some remarkable studies in models of memory, which show that organisms that are maintained or kept in relatively boring environments seem to lose their capacity for memories of making new memories compared to organisms that are in rich environments. And we can translate that into our own day-to-day behavior by trying to stay very engaged with our brain.
What's amazing, and we were discussing alternative medicine on yesterday's program, is how much power that the brain itself has in healing the person, in healing the human being, him or herself. Have you seen any proof through your research about how the brain can affect us physically?
Oh, there's so many examples of how the brain exerts its control over our capacity to both deal with and also recover from illness. Just as a brief starting point, I think it's important to know that the brain is the organ that we use for even recognizing illness.
Mm-hmm.
And there are examples of unfortunate patients with strokes in a particular region of the brain who are unaware of their very illness. And, of course, this can get in the way of recovery from diseases. If you're not aware of your illness, then it can be very difficult to know what to do as part of your recovery.
Dr. Lowenstein, I understand you can be with us for another 10 minutes?
Yes.
Okay, great. We're going to be back with more of our conversation on the brain, and this is Talk to America on the Voice of America. If you'd like to learn more about our program or you care to access our internet audio stream, visit our website at voanews.com/talk. We'll continue our conversation on the human brain after we take this 2-minute break. Stay with us. This is Talk to America.
Welcome back to Talk to America.
Hello again, I'm Rick Pantaleo, and today we're talking about the power and ability of the human brain. My guests are Dr. Daniel H. Lowenstein, MD, Vice Chair of the Department of Neurology at the University of California at San Francisco, and Monica Herdahl, Assistant Professor at the Department of Mathematics at Florida State University. Before we went to break, we were talking a little bit about the different physical aspects of how the brain is impacted, and I know genetics has always played a factor as well. But Dr. Lowenstein, I know you only have a few minutes with us, so we're going to ask a few of these questions directly to you. What about gender and racial and cultural aspects? What kind are there differences among, say, for example, people who live in Europe versus people who live in Africa versus people who live in the United States? Do we have different brains?
The research thus far doesn't show that there are major differences among cultures and races in terms of the genetic contributions to brain function. I think it's fair to say that the differences that we all recognize that come out of culture, that are a result of culture, have to do with the environment that a person is raised in. Mm-hmm. Physical and in terms of relationships. That being said, there is no question that gender, the sex of the individual, has a huge impact on brain function, and that should really not come as too much of a surprise, given that one of the chromosomes between men and women is quite different, and so there's a number of genes that are expressed in one versus the other.
I understand physically that the male brain is, what, 4% larger than the female brain? Is that because men are generally physically bigger than women?
Well, I don't know the real reason for that particular figure, although I don't know whether it means anything in terms of function. I doubt it does.
Well, as a woman researcher, Ms. Herdahl, how does that impact you?
Oh, it's a non-relevant point. I mean, there's no issue regarding that at all.
Okay. Looking at some of the illnesses that when you're talking about the brain, you're talking about physical illnesses and mental illnesses. And I know mental illnesses have physical symptoms as well. But let's talk a little bit about some of the diseases that affect the brain. Number one being Alzheimer's, being the big concern of today, since population is getting much older and the chances of getting Alzheimer's are becoming greater and greater. And Alzheimer's, along with other forms of dementia. What is the basic cause of Alzheimer's, Dr. Lowenstein?
Well, again, we don't know the underlying cause at this point. However, once again, as has happened in the field of epilepsy, genetics seems to be giving us some very important insights as to the cause of this incredibly common disease. Mm-hmm. In a relatively rare form of Alzheimer's disease that runs in families, we now know that there are a number of gene products of proteins that have mutations that contribute to the malfolding or the abnormal folding of proteins within the cell. And as your listeners can appreciate, the cells in the brain, like all the other cells in the body, have a very sophisticated sort of symphony of activity of tens of thousands of different proteins, mm-hmm. that have to be perfectly formed and transported and function in different regions of the cell. When a mutation occurs in some of these important proteins, they get malfolded and they kind of back up the system, mm-hmm. and accumulate sort of like a garbage dump within a neuron. And the neuron can take just so much and eventually gets destroyed by this backing up of material.
And you mentioned genetics, which is one point. And Ms. Herdahl, in your research, have you seen any differences between people with the different medical conditions, I guess biological conditions that we've been talking about, Alzheimer's, and of course you have things such as Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, cerebral palsy, and such. Do people with these diseases display any particular markings in some of the research that you've done?
Yeah. By the way, it's Dr. Herdahl.
Okay. Thank you for clearing that up. Yeah. I appreciate it.
I'm not a medical doctor, but I do have a PhD.
Okay.
Yeah, there's, again, in terms of the genetic aspect, I'm not really looking at that aspect in my research, although there is a lot of other work going on in that field. But most certainly, again, one of the things that I'm focusing on is looking at these different diseases and trying to quantify the differences in the brain, mm-hmm. particularly in the anatomy or the shape of the brain in some of these different diseases. And there have been different markers or metrics, what we call morphology indicators, between some of these different diseases. For example, as I mentioned before, we were talking about the thickness of the brain. Mm-hmm. And there's been some studies that show in Parkinson's disease, as say compared to Alzheimer's, like in Alzheimer's, they know for sure the brain thins in different areas as compared to normal subjects. In Parkinson's disease, I'm not sure of exactly what sort of morphological markers have been found directly, but for example, in other types of diseases like schizophrenia, they have found or there have been indicators that a different region of the brain is affected and might be a different shape. But of course, understanding what is reasonable variability for someone who doesn't have the diseases compared to someone who does have the diseases makes this very, very difficult, very tricky. So even though after the fact we can do these studies and say, oh, yes, this group of population, this population group has these markers which seem to be different than you know, healthy subjects, to use that as a diagnostic tool at this point in time is just not feasible. So we still have a long way to go. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Lowenstein, I know you have to go, so I'll ask you one last question. When you're looking at genetics and you're looking at a person's physical makeup regarding whether or not they will get Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, or any of the other of these debilitating diseases, we've also seen genetics being used as a way of showing that, yeah, there's a possibility that you can get this disease, but also offers a way of preventing you from getting the disease. Is this available with these medical diseases affecting the brain? In other words, if we know that our history shows that it's a possibility that I can get Alzheimer's, are there steps I can take to prevent that from happening, or at least delaying it?
That's a wonderful question, and the answer at this point is not quite yet.
Mm-hmm.
However, with the advances that are being made in genetic technology and our ability to start addressing some of the more complex forms of genetics that are a result of multiple genes working together or not working well together, I would say that we're easily within 10 years of the day when all of us will have the ability to understand what our own individual genetic code is, and it will give us insights into the kinds of steps that we can take right from the time of birth or maybe
mm-hmm.
even before
mm-hmm.
To try and completely prevent or at least significantly slow down these kinds of processes that underlie disease so that we can live longer and healthier lives.
Dr. Daniel H. Lowenstein, MD, is Vice Chair of the Department of Neurology at the University of California at San Francisco. Doctor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
And we continue with Dr. Monica Herdahl, who is an assistant professor at the Department of Mathematics at Florida State University. And if you're wondering, I thought the topic today was about the brain. What does mathematics have to do with it? Well, we've learned so far that it has quite a bit to do with it, and is showing a lot of promise in the field of research, brain research. What particularly motivated you to use your mathematics skills in this particular area, Dr. Herdahl?
Well, I've always been interested in biological problems, and And of course, I've always had a love for mathematics. And in the last sort of 10 to 15 years, there's been this huge, huge development in a field called mathematical biology, where mathematicians are becoming more involved in biological problems. Historically, mathematics has played a role in terms of applications in physics and chemistry, business, but biology has sort of been one of the last sciences to really use a lot of difficult mathematical modeling. Now, it's always been used. I mean, definitely there have always been people using mathematics in biology, say, to look at ecology, population epidemics as some sort of examples. But really in the sort of last 15 years or so, this sort of type of application of mathematics into biology has gained a lot of popularity, a lot of ambition. It's accessible to a lot of students who are interested in biological problems. So I was always in that group of students, and I've always been interested in biology and applying mathematics. Certainly, some of the mathematics I use is very theoretical, that has been developed by more pure mathematicians who develop a lot of the theorems and proofs. Mm-hmm. And we certainly need those types of mathematicians to develop a lot of the techniques that I use in my research. But it's a really exciting field. There's many, many different areas, not just in terms of the brain research, but other biological systems, anatomy. It's been embraced by the National Science Foundation and other research organizations, and in part because it's recognized that with the human genome being decoded, and that biologists need to become more quantitative. And so I'm very much interested in part of that.
I believe we have a caller on the line from Nigeria. Hello, Nigeria. I don't have your name here. Go ahead. You're on Talk to America. Joseph, nice to hear from you.
How are you?
I'm doing great. How about you?
I pray you get quickly over your bronchitis something. I know you read too late into the cold. Good work.
Thank you.
This is a very important topic. And my questions are to Drs. Lewinstein and Professor Hodu. Actually, when God made man, he made man in his own image. He did not specify brain or the heart. But in modern science, we hear about heart transplant. Do we have anything like brain transplant? And I want to know which one is more important to the body, the heart or the brain? And again, in brain disorder, where do we go to bring solution to the sufferer? Is it the brain?
Okay, it's an interesting analogy there, Dr. Hardal. Do we look at what's more important, the brain or the heart?
Well, I don't think you can really distinguish in terms of importance one from the other, because, of course, we can survive with neither, right? If you have a fatal heart attack, you could die from it, and similarly, if you have a stroke, you know, that could be fatal also. So we can't live without one. So in terms of their physiological importance, both are just as important as the other. I suppose in terms of a philosophical point of view, it depends if you're talking about romance,
mm-hmm,
or thought. So,
using your brain or your heart, I get you.
Exactly.
And what about the promise of treating it? In other words, if you keep a healthy heart, will that also keep a healthy brain?
Oh, well, I'm sure that, that's definitely true. If you keep the entire body healthy, then everything sort of works together. So they can only all stay healthy together.
And we got a wonderful SMS text message from Marcian in Cameroon. Marcian is a chemistry student there, and he asks, how does the MRI help us today to understand brain diseases?
Well, the MRI is one of these technologies that allow us to get pictures of the brain, but the important advantage of it is that it allows us to do this non-invasively. So meaning that we don't have to go cut people's heads open, because I don't think we get too many people willing to do that. Or you don't have to go do brain surgeries to sort of understand what's going on with the brain. A lot of the early information from the brain actually came from brain surgeries or brain injuries. So while people were doing research or doing surgery, you know, they would poke around various spots of the brain and basically see what wiggled or what happened, and, mm-hmm. and that's how a lot of the information came about what parts of the brain do what in terms of function. But MRI scans or magnetic resonance imaging scans allow us to look at the brain non-invasively. So the other advantage of MRI is that there's no known side effects, so we can take multiple scans of people. So what this enables now is what we call longitudinal studies. We can take scans of people over time, and this is what's giving us a lot of information about how people age and how the brain changes as we age, because we do know now the brain does change quite a lot as we age. The other advantage of MRI is you can change what we call the parameters of taking the scan. So not only can you measure the anatomy of the brain, you can also measure the functional activity of the brain. And basically, functional MRI measures the deoxygenation of blood in the brain, indicating regions where the brain is more active. And of course, this gives us other information. So when you do studies such as memory type studies or motion type studies, movement studies, cognitive studies, you can see which parts of the brain are active. And these are all things we couldn't do before. And being able to do it non-invasively has really been a tremendous, tremendous boon to the field.
I'm quite curious regarding the MRI. As a layperson, when you look at an MRI, you see basically a picture of the brain, and it has different colors. How does a doctor or a research specialist get information from these different colors and actual physical image that's on an MRI?
Right. Well, each of the different colors corresponds to a different tissue type. A layman's way of thinking of an MRI scan is it's basically measuring water content or how many water molecules there are in the brain. And of course, different tissues have different amounts of water. So, for example, bone is hard and very dense, so it doesn't have nearly as much water as, say, the brain tissue. So bone appears as one type of MRI scan as white, as compared to brain tissue, which appears as a grayish color, as compared to the fluid which surrounds the brain, which is mainly composed of water, and so that appears as a different color on the scan, which in one type of scan called a T1 scan appears black. Mm-hmm. So these different colors correspond to different tissue types, and of course, medical doctors undergo training which allow them to identify the different brain structures based on the color and the tissue type.
Now, I'm not really familiar with how far MRI technology has developed in recent years, but usually when you think of an MRI, you think of an X-ray, things like that. It's a stationary photo. Are there actually technologies developed now that show the brain in action, for example?
Yeah, so this is what people are calling the functional MRI scans. So they'll take a sequence of pictures of the brain over maybe 10 minutes in time, and they'll maybe be, you know, I don't know, 100 pictures taken over 10 minutes. And so each of those pictures is a different time point of what the brain is doing. And mm-hmm. so we can then create pictures that indicate which brain activity is changing. They can tell us what brain activity is significant, because the brain, the thing to remember with these pictures is the brain is always active,
mm-hmm.
right? So from one time point to the next time point, the brain is always active, but now it's going to be active in different places. So what the mathematics and statistics can do is tell us where in these different places the brain is active, and that's how you get these pictures that maybe show, you know, these colorful blobs or, you know, orange spots on the brain that you mm-hmm. see in magazines showing where the brain is active.
Now, in not only developing the imagery that we were discussing, the visual imagery, are you developing methods of helping doctors, researchers, analyze the data that they're actually seeing? In other words, when they're seeing that orange blob on the MRI screen, perhaps some explanatory data to explain what's going on in that area.
Yes. I've been involved in developing, pioneering a technique that we call flat mapping the brain. Most of the brain activity occurs on the surface of the brain, just like all the continents occur on the surface of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And but because the brain has all these folds, a lot of the brain is hidden from view. It's estimated about 60 to 70% of the surface of the brain is buried in these folds.
Right.
So as a visualization and analysis technique, one of the methods I've been pioneering has been to unfold and flatten the brain to create what we call a flat map of the brain, like you'd create a map of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this idea has been around for a long time, but what my method does is we're using a mathematical technique that preserves the angles when unfolding this brain map. And angle preserving is very important because that allows us to navigate better on the map. Similarly, like longitude and latitude lines
right.
allow us to navigate on the map of the Earth. Because we know from mathematics that it's impossible to flatten something that has a lot of folds or curves without introducing area distortion or
right.
length distortion. That's why, for example, Greenland always looks big on a map of the Earth, a flat map of the Earth as compared to the globe of the Earth, because you have area distortion.
Mm-hmm.
But we have Earth maps such as Mercator projections, which preserve angles, which allow us to navigate better on the Earth. And so I'm trying to apply mathematical techniques to do the same thing with the brain. So we can create maps of the brain, and then we can look at where the function occurs on these brain maps, and that will allow us to create ways of looking at different brain maps across different populations.
Are you suggesting then, Dr. Herdahl, that not only are we looking at the chemical composition of the brain, but we're also looking on how it's physically constructed and how it functions, or perhaps in other cases doesn't function?
Yes. Well, everything is all related, right? The chemical... neurotransmitters in the brain, they have an effect on the neurons, right? The
mm-hmm.
neurons send the neurotransmitters and the chemicals across the brain. So, of course, if there are deficiencies in the neurotransmitters or perhaps in the function of the brain, there are ideas that this may manifest itself anatomically and through the function that we can measure on the brain. And so these are everything is all related. You can't just talk about the chemical transmitters by themselves or the actual anatomy of the brain. Everything is all interconnected. Now, what's been difficult with the brain is because you have things on the molecular level like the neurotransmitters,
mm-hmm.
and if you want the global or macroscopic view of the overall functioning of the brain, this is sort of where the science is now. We can look at things at the microscopic or macroscopic level. But where I think the real advances are going to come in the next sort of 10 to 15 years is sort of filling in what's in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's really, we don't know a lot. That's where a lot of the unknown parts are right now in terms of the neuroscience as well as the modeling and the brain functioning.
So in other words, the kind of research you're doing, the kind of application that you're using mathematics for is mapping the brain and showing it not only from an overall physical look, but a more of a detailed look within the folds of the brain and so forth. So could this help in the future, help guide doctors or researchers into developing medications or surgical procedures?
I certainly hope so. Most definitely, one of the things that in any sort of collaborative or interdisciplinary research is that I'm using the mathematics to develop these techniques, which will hopefully help the neuroscientists. They'll be able to look at some of the tools that I developed, and maybe that will help them figure out which areas of the brain to focus on for whatever they're interested in. That region they're focusing on, again, will then drive other questions, which will in turn lead for me to try to develop other mathematical techniques and metrics or values to help them gain better insight into what's going on. So in a truly interdisciplinary collaboration, I'm not just working by myself, and the neuroscientists aren't just working by themselves. We're working together as a team, trying to feed off of each other. My mathematical techniques will hopefully help them gain insight and look in and ask new questions. And the answers to those questions may lead to new questions for me to look at to help them.
And again, application of your skills and your technique, you're looking at an overall mapping of the brain, but in the future they're looking at microbiology and genetics. Do you see your research extending in that area of help with research into the brain, looking into things from a genetic or a molecular standpoint?
Yes, most definitely. I mean, there's already research going on in that area. There are a number of mathematicians working in an area called computational neuroscience that are particularly looking at how particular neurons fire in the brain, how they're related to brain activity. There are many mathematicians and scientists looking at the genetic component and genetic markers, and I think over time all of these fields will merge, and you know, I'm sure my research will take a direction where, as we understand more about genetic markers and the role that genetics plays in brain function and brain disease, there will most definitely be some modeling involved in that area.
Dr. Monica Herdahl is an assistant professor at the Department of Mathematics, Florida State University. Thank you so much, Dr. Herdahl, for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to be sure to join us again tomorrow at 14 hours Universal Time for our next edition of Talk to America.